Well, good Sunday morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. The United Lodge of Theosophists is not the building, but is the collectivity of associates that make up the association that has a purpose. It has a purpose throughout the world. There are about 30 United Lodges of Theosophists and many more study groups. And the policy of the United Lodge of Theosophists is what we say independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. Independent as personal responsibility, one chooses as one decides to choose how and when and where he's going to apply theosophy and make it a living power in his life. The purpose of the lodge is to present the principles, the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy, as found in the writings of William Q. Judge and H.P. Blavatsky. The lodge is open and free to the public, regardless, of course, of race, sex, religion, ethnicity, and everything else. There are no fees associated with it. And in fact, the lodge considers theosophists anyone, whether they even have ever heard the word theosophy before, anyone who is devoted and works in the interest, in the true service of humanity. So anyone who finds themselves in accord with the principles of the philosophy and with the policy of this lodge is welcome to join in association with us. And if you have any interest, certainly you're welcome to talk to the student at the desk out front. But the purpose at the end of the day, the purpose for the lodge is to present these ideas, keep them before the public so that we can all use them in such a way that helps us individually and collectively grow in certain ways that we can more clearly recognize that universal brotherhood is the fact in nature. Now, to carry this out, we have two meetings per week. Obviously, on a Sunday, it's from 11 to 12. And during the winter or during the summer here, the topics for Sunday mornings are excerpts that are taken from the pages of Isis Unveiled. Today's topic happens to be philosophers or genuine philosophers. And if you don't have the text of Isis Unveiled, you certainly can pick up each week what's going to be addressed the following week from the shelf over in the back of the room. But also you can go online. If you don't have the book, you can go online to ultphoenix.org and read Isis Unveiled for free, download or print whatever you find necessary. So today's topic this Sunday is genuine philosophers. Next Sunday it will be the self. And these are broad topics open to discussion. On Wednesdays, we study the Bhagavad Gita, each Wednesday from 7:45 to 9 during the summer. And the lodge opens at 5:30. Everyone's welcome to come early to read the part before and prepare for the class, or if there's any other issues that you're looking to study, any personal lines. It's a wonderful library that we have, and it's open to the public from 5:30 to 7:30. The lodge is sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, money, and service, and all are appreciated. But none is imposed or nothing's imposed or implied upon anyone. There's no required membership. The only thing that the lodge requires, so to speak, is if you're coming here, then really entertain and consider the idea of universal brotherhood being the fact. And work toward more fully understanding that. So, I think we covered everything there. Today's topic is genuine philosophers, and the way that we're going to carry out the class today is we will have three readings. There are actually four paragraphs, but we've broken it up into three readings: the first paragraph, the second paragraph, and then the third and fourth. And because this topic it can be a very broad topic, and this discussion can be as deep as it can be broad. So we're going to start off with the first paragraph, and we'll see where some discussion leads. Then we'll get into the second and have a few minutes of discussion, then the third. And then in the second half of the meeting, the floor will be open for anything regarding the topic of genuine philosophers. And we'd also like to start with, genuine philosophers in this sense for today's, on the one hand, it could be a synonym for a Mahatma. It can be interpreted like that. But it also can be interpreted, a genuine philosopher, it can also be interpreted as any of us who are on the path, wherever we happen to be on that path, who are seeking to implement the philosophy of theosophy in our lives in as universal a way as possible. So that being the case, let's begin with the first reading, and then we'll have discussion after.
But Plato could not accept a philosophy destitute of spiritual aspirations. The two were at one with him. For the old Grecian sage, there was a single object of attainment, real knowledge. He considered those only to be genuine philosophers, or students of truth, who possesses the knowledge of the really existing, in opposition to the mere seeing, of the always existing, in opposition to the transitory, and of that which exists permanently in opposition to that which waxes, wanes, and is developed and destroyed alternately.
Thank you. So does anyone have any considerations given this on what real knowledge is? What's the difference between real knowledge and knowledge that's not real? Yes?
Well, before one begins questioning, it recalls to us that it's the three fundamentals that we find that we talk about in theosophy, and sort of embodies that, we thought that was sort of reassuring that when you read Plato, which is very difficult, that there is a spiritual side to what it is.
Thank you. So the contribution here is that we can see that there is the fundamental propositions of theosophy that can be found in the idea of real knowledge, and that one who makes the effort to read Plato, sometimes it's not the case in college courses, but a very real sense of spirituality can be drawn from it. Yes?
I read something last night about real knowledge from Ibn Sakhadatta. Anything that is an affirmation, any affirmation, denial is more likely to be true.
So a contribution here, something regarding real knowledge. Did everyone hear that? That an affirmation is probably more likely to be false, but a denial is more likely to be true. Why would that be the case? So the contribution is because everything that we affirm is eventually going to change. And so in a way that relates to one way to describe the absolute is really because it has no attributes and we can't explain exactly what it is, it's easier to explain what the absolute is not. And along that line, we'll just leave it at that, it kind of parallels the contribution here. In the back with the orange?
The last part of the last sentence, we think, speaks to what was brought up. Of that which exists permanently in opposition to that which waxes, wanes, is developed and destroyed alternately. Well, those would be the ideas that we hold, the affirmations, the denials, the things we find to be true or not true through experiment, sacrifice, study, all of the things that will lead us to true knowledge, which is the permanent. But yes,
Thank you. So the contribution here is along the lines in our pursuit of truth, in our pursuit of the truth, HPB says that the theosophist, in defense of theosophy and students of theosophy against attacks by the spiritualist of her day, that students of theosophy adhere to no dogma, regardless of the doctrines and the teachings and the ideas that are found in the teachings of theosophy. It may well be that most of the theosophists that you know accept certain things as being true, but that is not a requirement. It's not that theosophy requires people to think a certain way. Just because some theosophists think that way, that doesn't mean that there's a requirement. So along that line, in her article, what was it, Society Without a Dogma, she says that genuine students of theosophy are the first ones to throw out their idea of the truth if what they hold is true is demonstrated to them to be wrong. And we think that's the case because it's not my stuff. It's not my personal stuff. What are we trying to do? We're trying to pass out the ideas as we understand them as clearly as possible. And if we find a better way to do it, and we're resistant to that, then that may open up some kind of window into our motive if we're resistant to accepting the truth. Hand in the back.
Just two things that an older student said that always helped. And one was, build a framework from what you understand so far, and then fit the ideas in. If they don't fit in, rebuild your framework. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was very helpful. But the other, as to what is true, we didn't understand this whole idea at all, Plato's things in themselves sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't get it. And it was explained to us, consider a power, any power, the easiest one. Consider the power to see. No matter how much you've used it, you haven't worn out that power. And the only thing you can never see is the power to see. It is the power that is true, not its use.
Thank you. So this idea of real knowledge, you know, of the always existing, of that which is permanent, on the one hand, generally speaking, we recognize that there is something within the human being which is that permanency. Is that permanency. And the idea here is even the thing in itself, which is in English the closest way that medieval philosophers came to this. In theosophy, we use the word noumena. You know, we know what the phenomenon is. So that this pen is a phenomenon of all the things that went into making the pen. We can see it, smell it, hold it, feel it, touch it. But the real knowledge of it, the always existing, is the thing in itself, and it's the noumena. Take away all of the perceivable things. So it gets a little abstract, but it's helpful in identifying what we are, or perhaps it's the idea is more helpful in identifying what we're not. Yes?
My question is that if the real permanent knowledge, immutable knowledge, exists beyond this physical, changeable world, manifested world that we're in, how can we possibly know of that existence in the higher planes beyond this physical realm? How can we possibly be conscious and knowing of it if it's beyond our senses? Without your library, of course. I mean, granted, by the time I get to the library, I can read all about it. But as a normal human being who doesn't have this resource, how could I possibly know about it?
How could one possibly know that there is this higher realm? Well, let's say there are no libraries and no cities, and put ourselves back into the 1100s in the middle of North America. Is there anything that we can see around us that is permanent? Yes, in the right here in the white.
There's nothing in this world. Everything is transitory. Everything is whichever has a beginning has an end.
So everything that has a beginning that we see has an end. And yet, there's this collective understanding all of the indigenous tribes honor the great being or the great spirit. There's the one that always has been and always will be. So if there's knowledge of spirit, then there must be knowers of the knowledge of spirit. And we're told that really we have the knowledge. It's just that we're in a certain set of conditions whereby we are blocked from access to it, because we've demonstrated that if we did have access to it, we would abuse it. So the onus and the burden is on the human race, as we find ourselves in these conditions, to grow in certain ways that are necessary to grow in knowledge. And it's all a personal effort. That being said, let's take a moment and go to the now, any questions are going to be invited section by section, and then also in the last half hour of the talk. But let's get to this section. The second section will be read now.
Very few Christians understand, if indeed they know anything at all, of the Jewish theology. The Talmud is the darkest of the of enigmas, even for most Jews, while those Hebrew scholars who do not comprehend it do not boast of their knowledge. Their Kabbalistic books are still less understood by them, for in our days, more Christian than Jewish students are engrossed in the illumination of their great truths. How much less is definitely known of the Oriental or the universal Kabbalah? Its adepts are few, but these heirs, elect of the sages who first discovered the starry truths, which shone on the great Shemaya of the Chaldean Lord, have solved the absolute and are now resting from their grand labor. They cannot go beyond that which is given to the mortals of this earth to know. And no one, not even these elect, can trespass beyond the line drawn by the finger of the divinity itself. Travelers have met these adepts on the shores of the sacred Ganges, brushed against them in the silent ruins of the Thebes, and in the mysterious deserted chambers of Luxor. Within the halls upon whose blue and golden vaults the weird signs attract attention, but whose sacred meaning is never penetrated by the idle gazers, they have seen but seldom recognized. Historical memoirs have recorded their presence in the brilliantly illuminated salons of European aristocracy. They have been encountered again on the arid and desolate plains of the Great Sahara, as in the caves of Bellefonte. They may be found everywhere, but make themselves known only to those who have devoted their lives to unselfish study and are not likely to turn back.
Yes?
Well, what is it meant, spiritual aspiration?
From the first paragraph?
Yes.
What is meant in the first sentence, but Plato could not accept a philosophy destitute of spiritual aspirations. Well, aspirations are desires, aren't they? They are part of our emotional nature, our karmic nature. But where desires on a personal level are considered ambitious desire, I want more, I want to control more, I want to get more for me and have more. Desire as aspiration are the higher level, the use of desire in a higher nature. So aspirations is more along the lines of, I want to become more, to be able to serve more. What do I need so that I can do more with what I have? So Plato simply here is saying that if philosophy is not comprised of ideas of spiritual aspiration, how could it possibly? He says it's not philosophy unless you can synthesize it with spiritual aspiration. Yes.
Like the first paragraph, if we don't separate the true from the false, in this paragraph, if we haven't prepared ourselves and at the end devoted our lives to unselfish study, not likely to turn back, then there's no way we would be fit to see a master or a guru or come under their tutelage. So again, it's recognizing truth, being willing to sacrifice it, that devotion that's talked about, and it is said that it could be right there and you would never know it. And it's just an amazing idea.
Thank you. So then the first paragraph is the idea of what is the philosophical idea all about. And the second paragraph seems to be, very short, but very rich in the idea of there are those who pursue the philosophy. There are those who already have attained, say, illumination. And they are all about us. And if one expects to attain illumination, then one needs a teacher and will not be accepted unless, they are not likely to turn back as they devote themselves to selfless study. Thank you. Yes?
Well, there's a contradiction there, because every human being on this planet has the opportunity every minute of every day to deal with a master. We have the printed text of the Bhagavad Gita. We have the Sermon on the Mount. We have writings and ideas that have always been there for us, the life as well as the teaching of the Buddha. So it goes back again to a question of choice. We're not as much interested in that as we are interested in the celebrity of the entertainers or the athletes. We do what we want to do, basically.
Thank you. So the contribution here is, if we make the effort to study and study in such a way that we can put the ideas to work, and to study life around us as well and grow and benefit from that, then what we're really doing, if our motive is right, is we're putting our minds in sync with the very ideas of the masters that have passed the ideas down through now the teachings, the pages in as found in the writings of Blavatsky and Judge. So in a way, the contribution here is, really there's no excuse if one wants to do it. It's a matter of deciding to do it. And while somewhere along the path it is said that you'll be introduced to the master when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. But along that path, let's just start from where we are. Anywhere we look, there are plenty of folks who are further along that path in certain ways than we are, and are we receptive to the ideas they present? And just as importantly, perhaps more importantly, we may in certain ways be further along the path than other people, and are we willing to take the time and make the effort to assist those who seem to be struggling? So The opportunity is always there, both in the writings, and there's always others that we can learn from and others that we can always teach. Yes?
It all goes back to, I think, the spiritual aspirations. The aspirations of I aspire to be a great singer or a great teacher or the aspiration must not be I aspire to be a master. The aspiration must be, I want to help as many people as I can and devote myself to the service for humanity. And that is what it says at the end of the second paragraph. Those who have devoted their lives to unselfish study and honor that of the
planet. Thank you.
So the goal, the woman who comes to the master and says, I've done everything you told me to do. And he says, you're still not ready. because her goal was to become a master.
Thank you. So this spiritual aspiration is related to our desires and our emotions. Therefore, it is related to our motive. And as said, the contribution here essentially is if your motive is to become a master, then your motive is selfish. If the motive is to be of service to others regardless, because it's the right thing to do, rather than expecting something in return, then nature recognizes you as a co-creator and makes obeisance. Yes, in the back?
The question always is, who am I? What am I? And first coming into the room, the first thing we hear is the reading of the Declaration. The Declaration mentions that we work at disseminating these three fundamental principles. So I have to think about those if I want to get a better understanding. And at first we don't. So hope springs eternal. And we want us to insist on checking things out thoroughly. So aspiration that goes, that the philosophy that exists around that view,
thank you. So then the philosophy that exists without aspiration is just not a philosophy. It seems that aspiration, all right, if to continue along the path, it is dependent upon our own self-induced means and self-devised efforts. The aspiration, as we said, is the desire to continue along the path in greater ways to be able to serve. But it's not just the aspiration, it's not just the desire, it's also got to be the imagination and the will to do it, the will to overcome that which we put in our own way, to overcome that. Was there another hand? Yes.
Tying something back to a question from the first part, it was said 1,100 years ago, what do we see that's permanent?
Mm-hmm.
We were thinking an expression of the one and only law, which is cycles. We have the people understanding they plant at a certain time of year, they reap the next fall, the sun is rising and setting, and the seasons of the year. So we absolutely forgot where we were going.
Cycles
so
versus
nature helping on. So in the second paragraph, if we were to be working in harmony with those cycles, taking the time, you know, at the beginning of the year, nature gives us an extra boost, that the aspirations we make for the year that are usually gone by February 2nd, and we have this tide of energy we know about. Well, if we work with it, we'll be carried farther. Our efforts will reach out. So the point was made, nature will make obeisance and help us reach these heights we want to reach. We have to work in harmony with her.
Thank you for the contribution. So the contribution is to recognize the cycles around us and work with them, work with nature. And as we do that and follow the law, then we naturally unfold in ways according to law, according to universal law, rather than according to ways that we would like to grow. Now, of course, if we do that, the human being can grow according to the path of natural law and quicken his evolution by conditions we set within ourselves. So we don't have to follow the natural path of the masses. We can stand out and be separate and recognize that is when we follow the law, we can create those conditions that will quicken the evolution of the individual if one is willing to make that effort. Now, let's take a moment and go to the third reading and follow up from there.
Although the magician is believed as friendly as our spiritualists in the world of invisible spirits, none of them claim to produce his effects under their control or through their soul health. They knew too well how difficult it is to keep away the elementary creatures when they have once found the door wide open. Even the magic of the ancient Chaldeans was but a profound knowledge of the powers of simples and minerals. It was only when the theurgist desired divine help in spiritual and earthly matters that he sought direct communication through religious rites with pure spiritual beings. With them, even those spirits who remain invisible and communicate with mortals through their awakened inner senses, as in clairvoyance, clairaudience, and trance, could only be evoked subjectively and as a result of purity of life and prayer. But all physical phenomena were produced simply by applying a knowledge of natural forces, although certainly not by the method of legerdemain practiced in our days by conjurers. Men possessed of such knowledge and exercising such powers patiently toiled for something better than the vain glory of a passing fame. Seeking it not, they became immortal, as do all who labor for the good of the race, forgetful of mean self. Illuminated with the light of eternal truth, these rich poor alchemists fixed their attention upon the things that lie beyond the common ken, recognizing nothing inscrutable but the first cause, and finding no question insolvable. To dare, to know, to will, and remain silent was their constant rule. To be beneficent, unselfish, and unpretending were, with them, spontaneous impulses. Disdaining the rewards of petty traffic, spurning wealth, luxury, pomp, and worldly power, they aspired to knowledge as the most satisfying of all acquisitions. They esteemed poverty, hunger, toil, and the evil report of men as none too great a price to pay for its achievement. They, who might have lain on downy, velvet-colored beds, suffered themselves to die in hospitals and by the wayside, rather than debase their souls and allow the profane cupidity of those who tempted them to triumph over their sacred vows. The lives of Paracelsus, Cornelius Agrippa, and Philalethes are too well known to repeat the old sad story.
Thank you. Yes?
I don't know these lives. Can someone give us a summary of who these people are?
The last few people mentioned? Yes. So who are Paracelsus, Cornelius Agrippa, and Philalethes? Well, Paracelsus, as we recall, was around during the 17th century, in the last quarter of the 17th century, and he was an agent of the lodge, of the Great Lodge, who contributed significantly to science and to the medical field in his day, but it was so advanced that he was calumniated and not accepted and recognized for who he was. So, and he lived a life of misery after having attained his degrees, his letters in the European university. So that was one. So he's a member of, so to speak, HPV's tribe. Cornelius Agrippa, we can't remember specifically, but the Philalethes were a group in the second century in Alexandria, Virginia. Philalethes means lovers of truth. And their philosophy actually was known at the time as the eclectic school of theosophy that was began by Ammoniasakis. And these Philalethians, also known as the Neoplatonists, thank you, also known as the Neoplatonists, were abused as Cornelius Agrippa and Paracelsus, abused, shunned, and put to death by the wicked authorities of the dogmatic church in their day. So the message here is, though, you know, some people say, well, why don't I know a Mahatma? You know, if they're all over, why can't I see them? Well, first of all, if you see them, the only way that we're going to know that an individual is a Mahatma is by his spiritual nature. And the only way we can see the spiritual nature of an individual is through our own developed and refined spiritual senses. So if we're not operating from a basis of our inner faculties, we're not going to typically recognize someone who is that much more developed, unless for some reason it's decided that he will, so to speak, or she will express themselves to us in a way that we can better understand. And the reason why they are hidden or behind the scenes is because if they're made public, they get hung on a cross or they get calumniated, and that just impedes their ability to accomplish their mission while they're here. Yes?
Or, in a different way, helps it move forward. We think we're correct that Plato was taken into slavery at some point?
Yes.
During his life, he was teaching, he was philosophizing, he had students, but there came a point where he was taken into slavery with a whole group of people. And working and toiling as a slave day after day, finally, one of the upper caste said to the ruler of the time, "Don't you know who that slave is? That's Plato, the philosopher." And then King, or whoever it was, said, "Why didn't you say something?" He said, "I don't stop being Plato because I'm in slavery." So it's also an example of, through the suffering and the sacrifice, the identity was held fast and the devotion was obvious.
Thank you for the contribution. Yes?
We find it interesting because we've always wanted to emulate these kind of people. But in reading The Voice of the Silence, they say that this path is path of suffering and all. You know, and when we think of that, of all the suffering in this world, you have to, I guess, sacrifice everything to walk in this path, to purify ourselves.
So the contribution here is that it's said that this is the path of suffering and woe. And so why is it, or what is it, the fact that everything must be sacrificed? Well, on the one hand, everything must be sacrificed, but on the other hand, everything is gained and nothing is lost. You know, if we refer back to that first paragraph, if we're going to trade the transitory for the permanent, which is the only way to attain the permanent, then certain sacrifices must be made. And if suffering goes on while this is happening, the only reason why we are suffering is because we're attached and we identify with certain things that are false anyway. We, in our essence, are that. Everything else around us that we see, touch, smell, feel, including thoughts and emotions, are not who we are. So the extent to which we identify with them and are attached to them is directly related to the level of suffering that we experience as these things in the outward world change. So if we release our attachment to them, then we rid ourselves of the suffering. At the same time, it is considered the path of woe. Woe not because the work is so hard, so to speak, but our understanding is because the path of woe is along the lines of he who has attained adeptship or mahatmaship, because the suffering, so to speak, that goes on there is the suffering that one feels as he or she watches over struggling orphan humanity, making the mistakes that they make? Doesn't every parent from time to time suffer in certain ways because of the mistakes of their own children? So this is analogous to the path of woe of the adept. Yes?
Wouldn't this suffering be avoided if the knowledge of the natural laws and forces be explicitly stated for the entire humanity?
Wouldn't suffering be avoided if knowledge of natural law were explicitly stated for all of humanity, which is the reason why we're here. And, you know, because, you know, we're told that more than anything else, the Western world is in need of the understanding of what? The nature of not what God is as a guy in a chair in a cloud telling everybody or directing everything, but that absolute, the absolute essence, which is what we are. So that's one. And another one, reincarnation and karma implies, or really imposes upon every human being, that he is responsible for everything that he does, thinks, and says. And unfortunately, we live in a society where the overwhelming majority either actively, deliberately, consciously believe that as long as I believe in my Savior, I'm in. And if they don't consciously, actively believe that, it's reasonable to say that their basis of thought is it's operating there in the background. Like somehow, some way, everything's going to be okay without me taking responsibility for every breath I take. Now, there was a hand here, the gentleman in the black. Okay. Yes. If people knew what the natural laws were, they still wouldn't believe it. Sure. How much, you know, is it worth the effort to teach all of the natural laws of electricity to a pygmy who's never seen a light bulb before? Aren't there other things that he can be learning rather than trying to put him through college to understand electricity? So the laws are there. There's a lot of things that are going on, you know, behind the scenes. Something that HBB calls preternatural law, and preternatural law is the set of laws which an individual doesn't understand yet, and attributes miracles to. So the adept, working with the natural law, can perform certain phenomenal works because he understands the laws behind it. If we don't understand it, if we're a theosophist, we know he's doing it under law, we just don't understand the law he's using. But there are those who think it's actually a miracle and has nothing to do with law, and we're told that the preternatural law. So it's a matter of, as we continue, we'll better understand. It's self-study. Yes.
Well, most people don't want this. They don't want to know this. They don't want to know that they're responsible for anything. I think it's because of the age that we're in. It's just that everything that's real to most people is what you see, what you feel, what you touch. And their desires are the real aspects of their being. So it's an empty life. Only when someone has suffered through that empty life many times do they look for something to fill that life up with real meaning.
So the contribution here is, you know, many people don't want to know the law. And whatever, you know, without respect to those preternatural laws we were talking about, how about the one law of karma and reincarnation? There are people who just don't want to know about it or make the effort to understand it, because if one does, then one has to accept this is a universe of law, cause and effect, or it's not. And to believe that I can be saved regardless of what I do, as long as I believe, that is not according to the natural law. So there are a lot of people who resist learning the natural law because they're not willing to accept personal responsibility But that doesn't stop the nature, the workings of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, in the pink and then in the white.
Well, the philosophy also states that at this point in time of our evolution, that we are not ready to hear all of those natural laws as yet, and that what we are putting out are for those who are being drawn to it. And folks that are not drawn to it, they're either not ready or they wouldn't understand or they don't want to understand. So at this point in time, those of us, well, it's kind of interesting that those of us that are here are interested in it, we want to put it out, and we want to help others. But other than that, people aren't really ready to hear everything.
Thank you. So the contribution here essentially is, you know, are we ready? You know, can we handle the truth? Well, as much truth as can be comprehended in this period of evolution is to be found in the secret doctrine. That is that we are told is the most that can possibly be comprehended by the human brain in this period of evolution. And so, you know, a lot of folks new to theosophy come in and, well, give me the secret doctrine then. Sure, but gee whiz, how much are you going to get out of it, you know? There's folks who have been reading The Ocean of Theosophy for 40 years, and every year you go back through it, and there's so much more. It's almost like, it's similar to, you know, oh, if only I had this, then I would be that. Well, what are you doing with what you have now? Could you be that if you just think a little different or rearrange certain things? So you know, if we live a life that there was an expression, when we were in the army, there was an expression, no slack. If you take all the slack out of your life, how much more could we accomplish in each day if we were more focused on doing that for the right reasons? Was there a hand? Did I still hear? Yes. And yeah, I'm sorry. I'll get it.
I think one of the most difficult philosophical concepts to understand is that this reality that we live in with matter, everything, is not real. It's Maya, as it's called in the Indian philosophy. And one of the philosophical teachers I knew who was a wise man, called it, what we experience is reality with a small r. It all goes away. Matter is something that does not occupy space. That was a concept that I understand that you explained it. But the real thing is reality with a big r. And that is what we can't understand.
And that's what we can't understand?
We cannot grasp really the concept of this reality with a capital R as opposed to the wording in the text we have are pretty much the same thing.
Mm-hmm, yes, and that's the challenge, is grasping that abstract idea of the thing in itself or the abstract idea of the noumenon.
And my breakthrough was when I said, I can't understand that you can say matter does not occupy space.
The
way he explained it is that even though it's hard, it is really all vibration.
Thank you. And the space is still there. Matter exists in space, but space is not dependent upon it.
We experience it as
yes.
Matter.
So when we in English say that something's not real, it's helpful to keep in mind that we're trying to translate an Eastern idea into the Western mind frame. And so it might be helpful to say that nothing around us is absolutely real. But the things of the senses are relatively real, and we can use them to learn and grow from, and those things are not just the table and the chair that we talk about that's not really here, but it is. Those things are also the thoughts. Thoughts are things. On the one hand, in the Eastern idea, thoughts are maya. But we use Maya, the relative reality, in our evolution. In the evolution of what? Of the evolution of everything is spirit and soul, ever evolving under the one identical law. And all of these experiences that we have comprise the substance of the soul. The soul is the stuff the soul is made of, is the stuff that it assimilates from its experience. So we create experiences, and one, the exact same thing for two different people can be a hugely positive thing for one or a hugely negative thing for another. We know an individual who lost a child, and it was, of course, the worst that can happen to a human being. But at the same time, decades later, she said it was the most spiritual experience of her life. And so relative reality is what we use to grow spiritually with, because our soul is made of the substance of the experiences that we have. In the white. Thank you.
Some people believe that every individual is very simply, and actually everything, every pencil, every light, is an embodiment of relative reality, an embodiment of certain laws. And you are drawn to those laws which you are embodiment of. And your attention and your interest will be simply directed towards those relative laws. So this fits into the whole idea of the destiny and the stars and things like that. So I think that ties into what we were talking about before. There's a difference between pain and suffering. From my experience, pain is one thing, but suffering is when I'm trying to follow other people's laws, follow other people's things. I need to stick to where my interest and attention is, because that is, I am just a big bundle of relative reality, of relative laws.
Thank you for the contribution. Yes.
Good that we remember that one of the reasons why we all don't get these ideas at the same time, given that there's 20 of us sitting in a city of how many million this morning, is that we're all on a different plane of understanding, of learning. If we imagine a never-ending ladder, each of us is on a different rung, perhaps. Some above, some below. Sometimes we have to go back and repeat a lesson before we can move forward, which is karma. That's the natural way for that to happen. So it has to happen. Each has to come to the understanding of these ideas on their own, with the help of others, thank goodness. But we can't say where anyone else is or should be. It's so difficult. All we can do is offer to talk about it.
Thank you for the contribution. So here, in a nutshell, we're all on our individual path. We all have our individual, so to speak, vibration. But while we're here, we can make the effort to, during the course of our lives, permanently change that vibration by learning and growing. And from time to time, come into a group setting where there is an understanding, a deeper understanding among people who are like-minded, who perhaps don't differ quite as much. But at the same time, with the evolution of the individual, when an individual becomes an accepted student, one of the prerequisites, and there are a number of prerequisites, but he's got to be able to put his mind in rapport with the master. And so we can do that while we're here. While we're spending 1,500 years in Devakan, that's a way. It doesn't happen that way. So make the effort while we're here. In the blue.
If that first paragraph.
Speak louder, please. Start over.
The first paragraph mentions. Uh-huh. But since we recall the mind, what happened 1,700 years ago, when anathema was, all these the words anathema were used, and there was a great battle taking place, and it seems that those that declared these anathemas won out and drove They didn't disseminate.
So here the contribution is, in the Western world, in the early centuries of the church, there was, within the church, there was a war that was fought, and it drove certain ideas underground, because the very people who aspired to these ideas, or who adhered to these ideas, were burned at the stake. So it drove these ideas underground, and yet the ideas have always been there, and have been passed on sub rosa, behind the scenes, and made available to those who would make the effort to learn them and who were worthy of trust. And really, with the establishment of the United States of America, which in certain ways is a re-embodiment of the broad-minded Alexandrians, we now have the freedom to share these ideas and make them public without. And that's not the case all over the world. We can talk about these same ideas in another place, and the door better be shut. Yes?
Well, that brings me to this question on this line here. To dare, to know, to will, and remain silent was their constant goal. So what does it mean to remain silent? Because here we're told that we should share.
Sure.
So how do you deal with that paradox?
Well, for sure, there are things that here at the ULT we talk about which not too long ago were esoteric and are not esoteric anymore. And in the day when they were, it's because it was so inconsistent with the church that your life would be in danger, on the one hand. On the other hand, the more that we learn about these theosophical ideas and commit ourselves to understand them, inevitably, we come in touch with things metaphysical. We come in touch with all sorts of different ideas from different religions. And there are things as we grow that one must use his discernment about talking with other people. You know, on the one hand, very simply, we wouldn't go into a particular Christian church and tell them they all need to be theosophists. A fool would do that. But at the same time, this bit about remain silent, wouldn't it be wonderful if all universities in the world were run by people who were wise enough to discern between the students who eventually would take this knowledge, abuse it, and hurt, versus people who would take this knowledge and use it. The accountants. Wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to identify students who would use their understanding of accounting to rip people off and not allow them into that school? That's exactly what went on in the mystery schools. You had of ancient Egypt, Greece, and ancient Europe, the Mediterranean. You had to prove yourself worthy to be accepted because you weren't going to be educated until you demonstrated the moral ethic. Today, that's not the case. And we've got people learning how to build atom bombs on the internet as a result of it. Yes?
Some of the ideas in this discussion might raise the hackles of an Aristotelian philosopher who might think they were way out of balance. For example, in terms of human psychology, if you don't identify with your body and your feelings to some extent, you're going to have a lot of problems. If you don't feel your feelings, or you gave the example of a woman who lost her child and it later was a spiritual experience. Well, if that woman doesn't identify, if you don't feel your feelings and identify and mourn and so forth, you're not going to have that spiritual experience. So if you only think in terms of the soul, you're going to be way out of balance.
Thank you. So the contribution is yes, maintain the balance. And it's good that this is brought up. What the emphasis needs to be placed on, if we didn't make it earlier, is to be fully human, recognize it, but realize that I am not the feeling. And the feeling is there and it's real. But if we observe it as the as the higher observing the lower, then we are much more likely to be able to use those experiences constructively and learn from them much more quickly. Was there one last question from the gentleman in the black? Yes.
Yeah, I agree a lot with what you're saying. I think it's not just getting all this knowledge, and like I said, you can read that book for 40 years, but if you never actually experience it, if you never actually have the feeling of it, you're not your feelings, but you're not your thoughts either. You're not your knowledge. If you're not actually having direct experience of the divine, what is this? It's something that's actually making it harder. Because you have all these thoughts and all these judgments and all this knowledge, that if you're not in that direct relationship, that can get in the way. So just putting out there and teaching everything without giving people that contact,
mm-hmm.
I think is hugely dangerous.
Thank you. And theosophy would recognizes that and would validate that. As long as the divine, the experience or the effort to experience the divine, as long as we recognize that that divine is within us, not an outside person, but the divine within. So with that, we're going to close the meeting, and our meeting is adjourned.